Greetings and welcome to Mind Matters News. I'm your host, Robert J. Marks. We're talking to Dr. Donald C. Wunsch 2.0, or the second, as the old people would say. He is the Mary K. Findlay Missouri Distinguished Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Missouri University of Science and Technology, where he is the director of the Kummer Institute Center for Artificial Intelligence and Autonomous Systems. He's won a lot of awards. He's published a lot of papers. And when I say I've published a lot of papers, usually I say some of them are good. And a lot of Dr. Wunsch's papers are good. So look him up on Google Scholar and you'll be able to see some of his papers. He's also a recipient of many awards. We mentioned he was a fellow of the IEEE. He's also received a Neural Networks Pioneer Award from IEEE. There is a sister society called INNS, the International Neural Network Society, and there he has received two awards, the Gabor Award and the Lovelace Award. Dennis Gabor, by the way, was a Nobel laureate, and the prize is named after him, and I think he won the Nobel Prize for the invention of the hologram. Lady Lovelace was the first computer programmer, and she wrote computer programs in the 19th century for the mechanical computer that was dreamed up by Babbage. And she had some very fascinating things to say about computers. She said, for example, that computers can never be creative. They can only do what they're told to do. So Don is the recipient of both the Gabor and the Lovelace Awards. So Don, welcome. And it's good to continue talking to you.
Thank you, Bob. It's good to be here.
It is good to be here. With me, it's getting more and more common to be anywhere. We've talked about artificial general intelligence. You had a curious take on that. You said that it really isn't a viable name. It isn't something that we should consider. Did I get that right? Kind of summarize that in a little paragraph, what you meant by AGI and what your stance is on AGI. I remember I asked you the question and you rejected the premise.
So a couple of things about that. One is that one thing that we are pretty good at, I won't say that we humans are great at, but we are maybe the only creatures that are pretty good at it, is dealing with paradox. And so a paradox is certainly around the idea of artificial general intelligence. So I'd like to talk about two folks who have weighed in on this topic, both of whom I admire and who have different opinions about it. So Jan LeCun, winner of the Turing Award, he has come out saying that AGI is unfortunately a term that we have to deal with because it's become so popular, but it's really nonsense because our intelligence is not general. We have all developed intelligence. We, by that I mean humans and animals, have developed intelligence based on the needs of the creature. And so my first PhD student, Daniil Prokhorov, and I, we were roommates for a while, and I remember one time he was joking about what he had found about a dog brain. He had found some article about a dog brain, and it showed how much of a dog's brain is devoted to smell. And his joke was that a dog is a walking nose. And my spin would be that a dog is a genius of olfaction. I personally know and have interviewed a human genius of olfaction, Walter Freeman, who developed the neural network models of olfaction or the processing of smell. And it's a very sophisticated capability. But if we humans had as much brain devoted to olfaction as dogs, we could probably smell things a mile away that we cannot even smell in the next room right now. And if we had the sensory capabilities, that adds to it.
So if I had a dog brain, I would smell good. Is that right?
You would smell well. You might not smell good, but you would smell well.
Okay.
And then for the opposite perspective, Demis Hassabis, most recent winner of the Nobel Prize, the most recent neural networks winner of the Nobel Prize. There have been four. One of them did not win it for neural networks. Leon Cooper won it for semiconductors, but he was on the board of their National Neural Network Society and one of the early neural network startup company founders. But most recently, Demis Hassabis, John Hockfield, Jeff Hinton all won the Nobel Prize. And I would have to put Hassabis first among those, all the prior recipients of Nobel Prize related to neural networks. And in fact, maybe among most Nobel laureates, because I think we will live longer because of the alpha fold for protein folding predictions.
Let me ask you, Don. I believe that there are other people other than Jeff Hinton or John Hockfield that were more deserving of the Nobel Prize than they were. Unfortunately, a lot of awards today are given by promoters, people that promote themselves and such. What do you think about that? Do you think there's people more deserving of the Nobel Prize than Jeff Hinton and John Hockfield?
Well, I would say that it's unavoidable that that some great talents get overlooked, and the field is full of stories of that. I think that there are, my best prize that I've ever received is the Pioneer Award, and I personally know people who I believe are more deserving than me that don't have it yet. And so there's always an element of that. But I would say that I've met John Hockfield and know his work well. That was the first paper that I read that brought me to the field. I know the work of Jeff Hinton is phenomenal. He has run rings around me in terms of the impact of his publications. But yes, there are people who are whose contributions are just absolutely stellar, who have not yet been recognized in that manner.
My choice for the Nobel Prize would probably be Paul Wurmos for inventing of back propagation with his Harvard PhD dissertation, and Bernie Windrow for his breakthrough work in the 1960s at Stanford. I mean, he did incredible things with neural networks back then.
Both of them are close friends, yeah. So I would put them up with anybody who's ever walked the face of the earth in the field. And another one that I would list is Steve Grossberg. They are giants, and all three of them have been a tremendous influence on my trajectory.
You mentioned you got an award, and you said you didn't deserving of it. I have a good
No, I didn't say that. I said there were
more deserving. Yeah. So I got a line for you. I received an award one time, and I of course wanted to present myself as a humble sort of person. And I says, I don't deserve this award, but I have lower back pain problems, and I don't deserve that either. So that's a good way. That's a good way to accept awards in the way that I think.
So I'll contrast with this with the field of fuzzy logic. In the field of fuzzy logic, it's very easy to point to one person. And Lotfi Zadeh was the father of fuzzy logic. And so anybody that works in the field agrees, no matter where they might not agree on anything else, but they agree Lotfi Zadeh was the father of fuzzy logic. And I knew him too. You can see my interview of him together with Walter Freeman, who I mentioned earlier. Those are available on YouTube. And these are giants. And we're very lucky to live in a time when it's as if technological progress was compressed. That I still think that we're in the infancy of AI and even in the infancy of computers. I used to say we're in the Stone Ages of computers. We may have advanced to the Bronze Ages of computers. There's a lot left to do. But the field of computing has moved so fast that a lot of the giants have overlapped. I'm about to turn 65 in 2 months. So in the short span of time that I've been in the field, 40 years, there have been so many of the giants that have overlapped with that period of time. People like Claude Shannon, who wrote perhaps the most influential master's thesis of all time, saying
he did digital logic. He worked for Bell Systems,
right?
Didn't it revolutionize the way the Bell Systems hooked up their connections?
Yeah, well, his doctorate was one of two people that that revolutionized information theory, but his master's was to say, hey, these switching circuits that you use for telephones, you could do Boolean algebra with them too, so you could use them for computations. And so the idea to use electronic switching circuits instead of the Babbage mechanical devices for computing, so he, you could call him the founder of electronic computing. So that's a pretty good master's thesis. Most people would trade their doctoral dissertation for that.
He was also a member of the Dartmouth Conference in 1965, where people like Marvin Minsky and John McCarthy and Claude Shannon and Ray Solomonoff got together. And that's where the word artificial intelligence was created. I think it was John McCarthy that did that.
Yeah, that's another one, by the way. Minsky came to the University of Washington and gave a talk while I was a graduate student, and I attended that talk. So there are a lot of good examples of people who have contributed to the field that are still with us. And so Eric Kandel of Principles of Neuroscience, he came to the university and gave a talk, and I attended that talk. He gave that talk to the medical school, and that tome, giant tome on principles of neuroscience, he later got a Nobel for that. So anyway, the names that we have mentioned so far, not Babbage, of course, not Lovelace, but many of the names that we mentioned were alive during this period, and many still are alive, who have made just towering contributions. It would be like knowing Einstein and Maxwell and Newton, and Kepler. You know, so it's just a marvelous period to be alive in this field, and we can all be very grateful for that. And so we do need to realize in neural networks, there are many people who have made, and many, I mean, still relatively small handful compared to the thousands or even millions of AI enthusiasts, and there will be many more who come because of the many great minds who've been attracted to the field. But a lot of the founding contributions have been made during our lifetimes, and many of those people are still with us. So it's really just an amazing moment in history.
Yeah, I remember, let's see, who won the, Roger Penrose won the Nobel Prize for his work in black holes, but unfortunately Stephen Hawking had passed away. He should have got the Nobel Prize along with, in tandem, but you have to be alive to get the Nobel Prize. So I think that a lot of things are happening. I do maintain, though, that this exponential explosion in artificial intelligence, that people talk about Moore's law and things of that sort, exponential increases are never sustainable. And I think that eventually the curve has to level out. When it levels out and how it levels out, I don't know what that is. But look, I want to talk about your paper. You wrote a paper called Artificial General Intelligence is Nowhere Near. Artificial Specific Stupidity is Already Here. And Policy Matters. And one of the things you do, you emphasize autonomy as a critical and if you will, a missing component of what we're calling AGI. Why is autonomy such a hard problem compared to the pattern recognition or large language models?
Well, and in fact, autonomy is something that the field is attacking. There's a lot of research targeting agentic AI and tools being even rolled out, some on a trial basis and some that you actually can use. But I do think that this is a major limitation. And so in my paper, I say that insect intelligence is ahead of the field of artificial intelligence in terms of these autonomous capabilities. Because if you released a fly into this room and I were trying to kill it, it would be pretty fair match. despite my much larger brain, the fly's agility would serve it pretty well. And if I keep the door closed, eventually after a large amount of effort, I would succeed. I might break some things in my office in the process. So it's amazing how much an insect can achieve with such a small brain. And we're just not that good at dealing with that. And so that comes back to my criticism of the term artificial general intelligence, to say that that intelligence that has been successful, both artificial and natural, has become specialized to a task at hand. And the counterpoint would be Demis Hassabis has explicitly stated artificial general intelligence as a goal. But he has wisely taken task after task after task to rise up a chain to move towards those objectives. So he started out with games and then made general game engines that could learn a set of different games. But that's still a very constrained environment. And then the problem for which he won the Nobel is a great example of the success of... So I think it's not a bad thing to have a goal that is reaching for well beyond our grasp, reaching for the stars, a quixotic effort. But I think it helps to have the humility to say this is a quixotic effort and not to proclaim victory prematurely. There are many examples in history of a premature claim of victory that backfires. So I don't think that any of the claims that we have already achieved AGI are anywhere near true. And also, I don't think the projections that we will achieve AGI by 2030 are true either. There are such simple failure modes of these systems that we have failure modes too, but still there are failure modes of these systems that humans would simply say, that's not intelligent at all. And yet there are things that these systems that can do far better than humans. But when my dad brought home a calculator in the 70s, and I had fun calculating factorials. It could calculate factorials far faster than I could. Put in a number like 99 factorial, and it gives you, in scientific notation, how big that number is. There are all sorts of things that computers can do better than us. But there have long been things. The John Henry song, driving the railroad spikes and a machine that could do it. But even having a railroad in the first place, there are things that machines can do that humans can't do, but humans created these machines. And the same is true with computers. There are things that you can design a computer to do something that you can't do, but there's still a lot of things that you can do that the computer could never do. And so if the building catches on fire, you leave the computer behind and you run out of the building. Too bad for the computer.
Speaking of things that computers can't do, you talk about Moravec's paradox. What is that? And why do AI systems still struggle with this problem, Moravec's paradox?
Well, I'm quoting from an article by LeCun, and I cite it. And as I recall, it's sort of the idea that you do something, and when you succeed, it's instantly, okay, that's not AI. That's a nice thing you did, but that's not AI. And I might be getting that wrong, so I'll follow the citation. But basically, that is a recurring theme. So, for example, when I entered college, they had just gotten chess machines that could play at the master level. But there were little hacks you could get to every now and then beat one. For example, they underestimated the value of pushing a pawn towards a queen. So they could do great tactical levels and be well ahead of you. But if you could slip a pawn down to the close to the sixth or seventh rank, you might be able to force them to trade a rook for that pawn because you're threatening to queen it, and you might be able to get some advantage. So I'm nowhere near master level, so it was hard for me to exploit that very often. But still, I noticed that these little weaknesses around the edges of such systems, but still, to play at that level was considered a goal of AI. And then fast forward to 97, and IBM trots out at great expense Deep Blue and beats the human world champion, Garry Kasparov. Well, at the time, I was already very interested in the game of Go, and I literally thought it would take a century to get there to beat the game, to beat a human champion in the game of Go. And I would encourage people to watch the documentary Alpha Go. And there's another one that came out just a few weeks ago, and the name escapes me. I'll put it on my website. Both of them involve the work that was done by DeepMind, led by Demis Hassabis, another major technical contributor was David Silver. He collaborated with the Turing Award winner Richard Sutton. They developed a computer that would use reinforcement learning to self-improve. And eventually, it didn't take anywhere near as long as I thought. So about a decade ago, they beat one of the top human players. And then subsequently, they beat the then reigning human world champion in the game of Go. And that is so impressive because it has a lot of challenges that chess doesn't have. So the number of board states is much larger. The non-local interactions are sometimes even harder to see. And the evaluation of a board state is much more challenging. So it's NP hard just to evaluate a board state. And it's piece-based complete to attack the problem of the game of Go. And this is to say, if every chess computer, if you had billions of the Deep Blue systems all reprogrammed to attack the game of Go, you would not solve it by brute force. But what they did still had a lot in common with brute force techniques, but the reinforcement learning tools that were applied were very powerful,
incredible,
and very well designed, and it was a major breakthrough. Major breakthrough.
You know, there's Emo Phillips had a great story. He says, "Yeah, a computer could beat him at chess, but it was no match for him in kickboxing."
Right.
You know, talking about swarm intelligence. Backtracking a little bit, I met a guy at Stanford. They called him the Fly Man. His total job was to explain the way that the fly works. And one of the big questions that he asked is, how does a fly land upside down on the ceiling? And he was working on that. I don't know if they solved that, how flies can land upside down on the ceiling. You talked about things that insects can do that are really remarkable.
Right. That's an example that I like to trot out as well. And so you might recall that I had Robert Pinter on my dissertation committee, and he was had a joint appointment between electrical engineering and zoology, and he was an expert on insect vision and insect modeling, and so we have an expert on that topic here, and he knew about Pinter's work actually when he came here. So that's a fascinating problem. You might remember Karen Haynes from her, from the IEEE Neural Network Council. She was coordinating student volunteers.
She ended up in Australia, didn't she?
Right. But not before she did a PhD with Tom Caudill. And okay. She wrote her dissertation in the, so I think it was Casperson advised her master's. And she wound up working with Tom Caudill on her PhD, and she did work on fly vision. And so what flies can do is really amazing. And the sine qua non is the ability to land and hold on upside down, landing on the ceiling. I have yet to see an AI-driven system that can do that. That's not the same as, like, if you made a a drone copter that could use the force, reverse the force of the propellers and force itself to be on the ceiling. The fly can land on the ceiling and hold on. and so that's a remarkable control problem. And so there's all sorts of stuff like that. So I think we need to have a lot of respect for natural intelligence. It goes a lot further and a lot deeper, and also it's more parsimonious than anything that's being done in AI. So having systems that can do so much with so little. So people are talking about tens of megawatts, hundreds of megawatts, even gigawatts for up and coming data centers, but we make do with 20 watts. And so prior to LEDs, this was about the amount of wattage of a nightlight. So dim bulb is no longer an insult to one's intelligence. It's actually a great compliment. What we can do with our dim bulbs is really remarkable.
It is. Yeah, it is incredible. Let me ask you another question about AGI. And you made this point in your paper, and I've been thinking about it, and I kind of agree with you. I think that 90% of the articles that are posted on the internet from these news services and stuff belong more in the National Enquirer than they do as a news story. And you raised the question, is AGI more of a marketing term than an engineering target? I'm not even sure who coined the term AGI. And what do you think?
I cite a book by the title of AGI, and so I think it's the first citation in my paper. So I've browsed that book. It's good. That's why I cited it. I speak about it favorably in the paper. So I think that's the best source for looking at the various definitions, the history of it. I also quote from the OpenAI definition of AGI. And some of this actually, it's not just marketing, there's also some legal ramifications. OpenAI recently, I think, renegotiated, that might not be the right word, but they have clarified the understanding of their agreement with Microsoft, because they had some terminology in there about when AGI was achieved, that it would changed the nature of their agreement. And I think that they realized that term was too mellifluous to yield a legally enforceable agreement. So I believe that they've renegotiated those terms. But I didn't put one of the news stories on my website. Maybe if I find one that I like, I might dig into that and put up a good one. You know, you were talking about a lot of the things should belong in the National Enquirer. I have an AI news feed on my website.
Yes, by the way, I looked at it, Dom, and it's excellent. You really keep up on things. So I would recommend it to our listeners.
Yeah, I update it a few times a week. It's personally curated, and I don't put stuff in it if it's real hypey, even if I like it. So, for example, there are things, I'm a user of the paid version of ChatGPT, one of the higher tiers. I'm a user of the paid version, the Google Gemini Pro, and some of the other ones I use too. I use Microsoft Copilot, and so these tools, they're flawed, but they're useful. So in all of them, I've found shortcomings that I would not tolerate from a human assistant. But they will make promises. They'll say, I will do something, and then they give you something, and they say, I've done it. And it turns out that there's just a hollow shell, and they didn't do anything that you described within there, particularly in the space of coding. And they're improving. So I don't think that things will forever be that way. But I do think that if you want to be a user of AI, particularly LLMs, you need to be very aware of its limitations. And that's one thing that I think earlier in the field, where people were not talking about such general tools, then there was a very clear sense that I'm designing an AI system to do X. And outside of X, it's useless. But within X, it can do what I want it to do. And then I can diagnose if it needs to be improved in this way or that way. And that's a good way for an engineer to think about AI. And it's very tempting to think of an LLM as an oracle. It does have a broader range of user interface. And so you could ask it about all sorts of things, but it takes more responsibility on the part of the human to decide whether what you're getting back is actionable, whether it's useful, whether it's true, whether it's been hallucinated or not. So you need to calibrate carefully. Often I'll be doing something right in the center of the strike zone of the AI. I'll be asking it for looking up things about a particular scientific topic, for example. It'll give me back something and I'll say, no, you need to try again. You need to work harder on this. You're giving me something very shallow, and there's stuff out there that I know exists that is a better answer to this. Go back, but I'll give it some hints. I'll give it some direction of look for this. And so it's really AI has been and will continue to be a powerful tool in the hands of humans. And the more that people realize that and use it accordingly, the more successful that they'll be in the application of AI. And there's a lot of work that's high consequence where you really need to get it right, or you're going to lose money or maybe lives. And so it's really important. If there's one thing that engineers need to know about AI, it's that the engineering mindset has always been to work hard to verify that the system works as intended, and to realize and declare the limitations of any system that you feel.
You know, Ronald Reagan used to say, trust but verify. I think with AI, it's kind of backwards, isn't it? It should be verify, then trust.
Yeah, maybe verify and then trust, but still verify.
But still verify. So, yeah. The other thing is that when you get responses from these different platforms, they seem so sure of themselves. Another Emo Phillips joke, and I think this is really true of these large language models and these AI platforms, is that computers are not really intelligent. They just think they are. And certainly they present themselves as they are intelligent.
So there's one thing in the article this reminds me of, and that is that there's a section about the threat of AI taking over. And so anyway, I think it's a red herring. So there are many threats of AI that really deserve our attention now. And a huge one is the threat of AI to our privacy. This device, I won't put the side with the brand on it because I'm not blaming any particular company, but our smartphones have created an amazing ability to spy on us. I would say that they have reduced the cost of spying on us by a factor of at least 10,000 and maybe 100,000. So they can track our every motion. They can be turned on even when you think they're turned off. You could then use the microphone and the camera and the GPS on the device. You can do all sorts of things with this if you have either the right authority or the right hacking capability to do that. And if you have all that, installing such software might cost you a few thousand dollars. But once that has been installed, then the marginal cost of using it to spy on somebody is just a mouse click. You know, it's negligible. So anyway, the ability to do all sorts of things to spy on people has decreased, I would say, easily by a factor of 10,000 and maybe much more. But what has still been expensive is to decide which people you want to spy on. And AI has reduced that cost. So in the past, I'd say we could take some cold comfort in the fact of, although it's very cheap to spy on us, it's expensive to decide that we're worth spying on. And furthermore, you know, I'm not a senator or a billionaire or a CEO of a multinational company or you know, somebody even more important than a senator. So my relative obscurity is a shield against the ease of which it would be to spy on me. So yes, if somebody really wanted to know to spy on me, they could spend a tiny bit of marginal cost. There'd be a one-time cost, but then the marginal cost to spy would be very low. But I can take some comfort in that that the cost of deciding to spy on me would be very high. Well, AI easily lowers that barrier. So if you had some parameters that you were trying to decide who to spy on, then AI would dramatically improve the ability to say that people with a certain, let's say a certain income level, a certain political persuasion, a certain sexual orientation, a certain religion, a certain geographic location, all sorts of criteria, a certain level of history and various public records, whatever they might be, a certain purchasing pattern. There are all sorts of things that would make it much easier to spy on people, intrude on their privacy. And that doesn't even begin to open the Pandora's box of social media. And so the things that we voluntarily disclose. So it's gotten to where the risk of AI to privacy is not some hypothetical future risk that we might arrive and we're debating about whether it's coming in 3 years or 5 years or 10 years or 30 years or never. These are risks that are already here that are not sufficiently appreciated. And so I would say in that sense that the concerns about AGI and the policy implications about what to do about AI have got certain risks backwards. And that indeed it behooves certain entities to encourage you to look at this family of risks and ignore this family of risks that I'm pulling off of the screen, right? So, but this family of risks are already here and already a danger. And if you say, hey, look at these, look at these. These are the ones already here and already a danger. And don't look at those ones. No, those are no problem. No, that's a pretty big issue. So, and also regulation creates barriers to entry. So there are entities that can hire armies of lawyers. You think about the trillions of dollars being spent on AI. And so literally of the top 10 companies by market capitalization, all of them basically trillion-dollar companies, 9 of those top 10 are AI companies. So how many lawyers can they afford to hire? As many as they want. And so so to have government regulations, they're needed, but they have the ability to hire lawyers and lobbyists. So they could create barriers to entry by having regulations that make it hard for new entrants. And they can also lobby to not have regulations that they're not very interested in. And so, for example, privacy would be a good example that privacy might interfere with their ability to market to you or their ability to do various things.
Well, you know, my daughter wants to put in an app and follow me wherever I am so she can note wherever I am, she will know. And I've resisted it. I don't want to surrender that. You know, in terms of privacy, I was doing some work with a nonprofit, and this one guy said, well, you know, maybe he can make a contribution. And the people at the nonprofit looked up this special service And they showed everything about this guy. I mean, he was rich. He was one of these guys that you said that AI should pay attention to. The Bible says that God knows the number of hairs on your head. It didn't go down to that detail, but it was pretty daggone close. And
I'm giving God a much easier problem with each passing year. you're right. Counterbalancing it. You're giving him a little more work to do here, but
we are. And we have a professor here that got a very nice NSF grant about mining information from publicly available social media. And his task was to do things like identify people that are possibly violent, have violent tendencies, might be in school shooters or people that might have a tendency to commit suicide and things of that sort. And all of that could be mined from all of this social media, and the person could be identified. So you're exactly right in terms of the loss of privacy. But again, with Amazon and Amazon.com and some of these other services, I have surrendered my privacy. I've surrendered my privacy to Google because their service is so daggone good that it's worth that trade-off. So that's kind of where we're at, I think.
Yeah, and by the way, this month, I think, is the last month that Google Maps timeline, they were keeping that on their servers. And now if you want to keep your timeline, it's pushing it to your device, but you can still keep your timeline. I kind of like my timeline, but it's a privacy trade-off. So
what do you mean by keeping your timeline? I don't know what that means.
If you look in Google Maps, there will be a menu item on the left-hand menu drop-down for your timeline, and it'll show everything that Google Maps has detected you doing over the time that you've authorized it. And so by the way, I do share mine with my wife and son. So basically, if something were to happen to me, they could find out where I am, at least where my phone is. They might not find out where I am, but they can find out where my phone is. And actually, that helped one time. So one time, I didn't have the same. This is a blue phone, phone jacket. But I had a black phone jacket. And I was in Washington, D.C., and I had a cart with a little black thing where the child can sit in. And in D.C., they charge you for the bags, so I had my own bag. So I checked out, and then I put stuff in my bags. And when I packed up all my bags, I didn't spot the black phone on the black child seat, and I left it in the cart. And somebody came along, and instead of turning the phone in, they took the phone, and then I didn't realize this, but I mentioned it to my wife after I did realize it, but I had to run off to a meeting, and my wife called the phone, and the person said, I want a reward for finding the phone. And so she could see where the person was. And he told her where he was, and this is remarkable. You know Hong, she's fearless. She went off in downtown D.C. to go meet this person, and she was on her way there, and I guess she ran into some people that she told the story to on her way there, and they said, "Oh no, don't do that. That doesn't sound safe." And they called the cops, and the cops came, and a cop went with her to meet the person. And he changed his mind about asking for the reward. And she said, "No, I said I'm going to pay you the reward. I'll pay you the reward and take the phone." And it turned out he was one of these vendors downtown on the National Mall. And he gave her and the cop a free bottle of water. Everybody was happy. But yeah, Hong is fearless. When I found that out, I was kind of horrified. But I got my phone back. But she was able to do that because I had enabled her to track my phone. The guy had told her where he was, but she was able to also see where he was. So it was interesting.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was off at like DARPA or something. I came back from my meeting and she told me this whole story.
That's really astonishing. So you've talked about some of the things that we should be careful about with artificial intelligence. On the page that you curate, where you actually go through news articles, you said that you censor some of the articles.
No, I don't censor any of them. I either put the whole article or I don't include the article.
Okay, but you...
I curate
you're,
them.
You're selective. Them. You're curate. Okay, that's a
good
word.
Yeah, I curate them, yeah.
So what are some of the key things that you look at in an article about artificial intelligence that let you know that it's clickbait or junk news or not worth posting?
Well, also, there's a lot of worthwhile articles that I don't put because, I'm interested in an engineering approach to AI. I'm interested in where the field is moving. I'm interested in its limitations and also its strengths. So for example, I will have more stuff related to the energy footprint of AI than maybe some other person with similar desire to run a feed. In fact, one of my friends, Daniel Toretz, of Auburn University, he used to be here at Missouri S&T, and he's got an AI news feed, and he does a separate cybersecurity news feed, and they're really excellent. Daniel Toretz, Tauritz, is a really good person to look up. Just remarkably prolific about choosing these articles. And he chooses different ones than I do, but very good ones too. He doesn't put any garbage up there. So, for example, I put up a New York Times article about the people who are suing OpenAI for these sycophantic chatbots that have encouraged people to commit murder and suicide and stuff like that. I put up things that relate to policy. So some of the policies that are currently changing the field that are being put out by the federal government, some of those I have put stories out about those or sometimes links directly from pronouncements. There was an executive order on April 23rd about AI for K-12 that I thought was important. So I just put that, there were articles about it, but I just put the executive order out there saying that the agencies need to do more to educate all our students about AI. And so basically things that are in the sphere that I think my audience would be interested in. So there are all sorts of things that are, like AI for games is huge. That book that I mentioned about artificial intelligence, that was written by Julian Tagelius, and he is also one of the people who's done a lot with AI for games. And so I'm very interested in AI for games. Particularly in the early phase of my career, I was working on AI in the game of Go in the late 90s and for about a decade beyond that. There are some of the things that are done with AI for games are still fascinating. The work that DeepMind did on StarCraft immediately after beating the champion in Go, that work was also quite fascinating. But I would say I don't post as much on entertainment AI and AI for games as I would have done if I had started the site a decade ago. I wouldn't quite say it's a solved problem, but I would just say that there are some that it's a mature, relatively mature part of the AI field. And I'm still very interested in it, but more as a customer than as a topic that I think is changing the world. But I do think that the tools that they developed in terms of AI games are extremely powerful. And so the LLMs are built on these reinforcement learning tools. The reason that they're so widespread is because these techniques really work. And so if you have designed the right cost function, if you've defined the problem correctly, if you define the problem in a focused enough manner that you can predict what the AI is likely to be able to be beneficial for you, then those tools are extremely powerful. So, for example, I was once asked about future of AI, and I was saying that I thought that there, I personally would be more likely to trust, an AI hedge fund manager or a mutual fund manager than I would be to trust an AI babysitter. but I would suggest that one of the risks of AI is that maybe the mass majority of the population are making the opposite determination. And that that I don't think is good. So I would say that a lot of people are de facto allowing AI babysitters because there are AI algorithms that are driving the social media feed. There are AI driving the gaming and making those more addictive. And so people are essentially subject to AI babysitters, and their performance might not yield the desired result, will not yield the desired result, I'll say it a little stronger. And whereas AI might indeed be able to be designed to do better than a lot of professionals in money management. I've worked in this field since the time I was your student in the late 80s and early 90s. I've published in this field as early as 1991, and some publications beyond, but I've never used it on my own money. I thought that I could do better. But I do think that it would not be that hard to design a tool using AI that would beat the average, say, professional money manager, professional mutual fund manager, professional hedge fund manager. And there are other people who have reached that conclusion, and some of them have already done this and made a lot of money. So you can look up Bill Simon. There's a book about him called The Man Who Beat the Market. You can look up David Shaw. David Shaw and Associates. These are people who have been interested in this and turned them into huge enterprises.
You know, Don, I knew the first professor of financial engineering in the United States. I forgot his name, but he was an interesting guy. And he was approached all the time by people that said, you know, I came up with a neural network that can forecast the market. He didn't even have to look at the software. What he did to these people that approached him, he asked the question, what kind of car do you drive? Because if they had been successful in doing this, they would have applied it and been very, very rich. So about the forecasting, it's very, I think it was Niels Bohr. There's an old Danish saying that Niels Bohr, the quantum mechanic guy, said. He said that forecasting is very dangerous, especially if it's about the future. We talked about some of the things that we use, some of the tools that are used to talk about fake news. I think one of them is that people that make totally speculative statements about what the future of AI is going to be. I also look for seductive optics and seductive semantics, for example, anthropomorphizing. They make a robot look like a human being or a dog or something like that. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden there is association with artificial intelligence with something which actually exists and exists in the sense that it's a human being. My wife, she used to just love our dog. And I said, don't love the dog. It's a dog. It's not a person. I think it's the same thing with AI. We look at it and sometimes say it's a human being. It isn't. I told my wife it's a dog. I think the people that talk about the future of AI is, hey, it's a computer. The other thing that I look at for fake news is the source. I always take with a grain of salt the words of people like Sam Altman or Elon Musk that are promoting what they are doing. They're promoting their company, and of course they're going to come out and they're going to be positive. So a lot of these things can be used to filter what the AI, what the good AI news is and what the bad AI news is.
By the way, you mentioned computational intelligence and financial engineering, and I believe you and I were both at the conference in about 94 in New York City.
Yes.
The Cypher conference, and I think we shared the hotel room, in fact, at the Marriott. Okay. And anyway, I got in a conversation with a fellow who was doing modeling I think he was using stochastic differential equations, and he was modeling deviations from the Black-Scholes model or something like that. And I had a fascinating conversation. And as you might recall, before I joined your lab, I got a master's in applied math. And I think that that was my edge when coming to talk to faculty members. And I came to you, and you were my first choice, and thankfully you took me as your student. And I found out that you could write down the math as fast as I could read it. So we're no slouches in math. But I had a talk with a guy, and he was doing this mathematical modeling using stochastic differential equations and other tools, and he was an economist. And so one thing that I would that I'm warning people about hubris in the field of AI is that like the business school students, the English majors, people like that, they are not what maybe people in their 60s and older envisioned those fields as being. When they went into STEM disciplines and saw these other people in non-STEM fields, some of them can run rings around us. And so this guy, when I looked at his papers, I had had this conversation with him and I was fascinated. I looked at his papers and I said, he's doing good work, but it's an awful lot of work to study his work. I would love to collaborate with this guy. And he was very friendly and had a great conversation for a better part of an hour and just fascinated by what he was doing. But I realized in 1994, I'm not in a position to keep up with this guy. His name is Philip Digbig. He got a Nobel Prize a couple of years ago at Washington University in St. Louis. So I had correctly assessed the chops that he brought to the table. But that's one exciting thing that was already true back in the 80s and 90s and remains true. The people that get attracted to this field are just stunning, what they bring to the table. And it does not matter what discipline they come from. I have learned things from our English faculty that changed the way that I approach the field of AI. We have psychologists and sociologists just doing amazing things. And I love to attend the lectures of our top historians, and some of them are just doing fantastic stuff. And so, the field has always been multidisciplinary, and it's getting even more so. So the people who are good at things like prompt engineering are very different than the people who are good at the mathematical analysis. And then the mathematical tools are sometimes very different from the ones that we focused on. So, even PDEs and field equations and stuff like that, they're important, but there are other things that are important too. And so that's one thing that I love about the field is the diversity of disciplines that goes into the field is just staggering. And I feel like a kid in the candy store. And so there's just so many different things to look at and read about and learn about and different people to talk to. And that's one of the most rewarding things about being in this discipline is that you can work on and learn about almost anything. If there's something you're curious, you can work on it. You can learn about it. So your former student, Iwan Sanjaja, got his master's from you. He's very interested in applying LLMs to the Bible. And yes, there's so many different fascinating questions about that topic. He's very excited about it. So there's in philosophy, of course, I was just revisiting the work of the late Daniel Dennett, who just passed this year, I believe. And he did some marvelous work in philosophy of AI. He collaborated with Douglas Hofstadter, who got his doctorate in physics, whose dad was a Nobel laureate in physics. He decided to try something different. After he got his doctorate in physics, he went into a computer science department as a new assistant professor, decided to write a book. His first book got a Pulitzer Prize. So, yeah, Douglas Hofstadter, Gödel, Escher, and Bach, An Eternal Golden Brain.
Oh, yes,
many,
yes.
Many great books since
great
then.
Book,
yeah.
Yes.
He's written many great books since then. So one of the giants of AI. So there are all sorts of people making all sorts of contributions. It's not all about the citations. It's not all about the awards. And we've just scratched the surface. So even if you know the subset of the subset of the subset that you want to focus on, you can easily spend 3, 4, 5 decades to delve into that facet of it, and there's a lot of work left to do. So if somebody wants to see AGI, let's say, I don't think that it's coming, but if somebody wanted to see AI that is across a broad spectrum of capabilities, including physical and mental capabilities, including being able to interface with the real world in a diverse way. If they want to see that in their lifetime, I recommend to do research on a longer lifetime. I think that will give you a higher odds of seeing these things in your lifetime than doubling down on just the AI aspect of it. So the embodied AI is already huge. You know, to like I talked about, if the building caught on fire, I'd leave my computer here and get out of there. To have embodied AI that can do something about the broader range of things, the broad range of things that we encounter on a day-to-day basis, it's just not that near. But if you carve out a real specific problem that we're interested in that's worth a lot of money, then yeah, AI might solve it way faster than you think it can. You might think that this is a century. You might find out next year, bam, they've got it solved. But as soon as you make it more general, it's a whole different ballgame. And so I am a big fan, as I already said, I make clear, of both Jan LeCun and Demis Hassabis. Hassabis deserves that that Nobel Prize for AlphaFold. That's a very specific intelligence. It's not a general intelligence. But reaching for that star of general intelligence helped him develop the tools that enabled him to solve one of the most important problems that we faced since the beginning of this century. And I think that the experts thought that that would take a century. It used to be that you would, if you could solve one protein folding problem, you could get a 7-figure grant from NIH immediately. And they solved like a 250,000 protein folding problems when they published their first result. And they're way beyond that now. There are literally millions of people using those tools. And so the impact is just tremendous, absolutely tremendous. So focused research on AI, I would say there's almost no limit to what it's going to do. But as soon as you start making these grandiose claims, I'm glad that people are excited about it and trying to do that. I just think that is not coming soon.
Yeah, I agree.
I'd love to be proven wrong, but I think that attempts to prove that wrong, and that's why I say near the end of the article, the challenge for IEEE members is that engineers have always had the attitude the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And so
Yes. People
who disagree with what I'm saying, in the article, I say that's encouraged. And the best way to express that disagreement is not with some grandiose claims, but, you know, I'm saying this from here in Missouri, the show me state. So the results can speak for themselves. And right now, the results are not telling a story that this is anywhere near. The results are fantastic. I mean, I have stock in some of these companies for a good reason. I believe that they're producing results.
Know, Don,
that
a lot of people think that some of these companies like OpenAI and Grok and NVIDIA are bubbles.
Well, I wish I had stock in OpenAI or Grok because private equity is a whole other thing. But I don't think that we're at an AI bubble. I think that such a thing could happen, but I personally don't think we're at one. But that I could easily be wrong about it. But the reason that I think that is that there's a lot you can do with brute force, a lot. And the problems that people are working on are so incredibly valuable. So I think that there will continue to be investment in expanding the capabilities of AI because they're so what is it worth to have a better drug target that can conquer cancer or Alzheimer's? What is it worth to stop paying people eight-figure salaries to run a mutual fund if you could do that with an algorithm that you own? You know, what is it worth to be able to lower the cost of getting something into space by three orders of magnitude? What is it worth to have a better solution for you know, energy availability and more? You know, there are things that are worth not trillions, but tens, hundreds of trillions or more that are problems that AI might be able to reduce the cost of and improve the efficacy of by orders of magnitude. So even though these top nine companies that I mentioned are all trillion-dollar companies, $9 trillion is a small number compared to the potential. Now, actually, those nine companies add up to about $25 trillion in market cap. $25 trillion is a small number.
It would it would make a big dent in the national debt, I'm sure. Hey, we've been talking to Dr. Donald Wunsch about his paper, Artificial General Intelligence is Nowhere Near. Artificial Special Stupidity is Already Here, Policy Implications.
Artificial Specific Stupidity.
What's that?
It's Artificial Specific Stupidity.
What did I say?
You said Artificial Special Stupidity.
Oh, I know some people with special stupidity. Okay.
So this is, I have this been guilty of being one of those people from time to time.
That's true.
That's it for this week. We'll be back soon with more from Dr. Donald Wunsch. Until then, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.